This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, a local writer takes a literary journey on a restored whaling ship. And our science reporter, Patrick Scahill, tells the story of the ham radio, from its deep local historical connections to the science that lets hams skip radio waves across the globe. But coming up first, Dan Brown is a literary sensation. His novel, The Da Vinci Code, provoked debate over biblical history, hidden symbols in art, and the presence of secret societies while selling millions and millions of copies. His newest book, Inferno, takes readers into some of the same types of worlds, but it also contains messages about what some see as a very real problem facing society today. As a fundraiser for Hartford's Mark Twain House and Museum, I'll be talking with Dan Brown on stage at the Bushnell on Saturday, June 7th. You can find out more information at marktwainhouse.org. We hope to see you there. Here to preview that conversation now is Dan Brown, who joins us by phone. Dan Brown, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
If you want to join this conversation with questions for Dan Brown, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive@wnpr.org, or you can tweet us at Where We Live. First of all, you're coming to Hartford as a fundraiser for the Mark Twain House and Museum. What's your connection to Mark Twain?
I'm a fan, I guess, as are most of us. I've actually never been to the Mark Twain House. I've always wanted to come, and I got a terrific letter from them asking if I'd come down, and I just thought, what fun, a chance to talk to you on stage, why not?
And we're going to have lots of people there who will have many questions for you, people who've read your books very closely and probably have a lot of interesting theories about things you've written. And we're going to be talking on stage in the Bushnell about some of the themes and ideas behind your books, some of your writing process. But because you're here on our news talk show, Where We Live, I wanted to talk to you about some of the themes in this book, Inferno, that we've actually talked quite a bit about on the show. And the first is overpopulation. Without giving up too much of the plot, the villain, and I put that in quotes of this book, wants to limit the Earth's population. Why does this particular topic fascinate you?
Well, it's a topic that is from the real world. It affects all of us in a very real way. It's funny, a couple years ago I heard a statistic that just sort of floored me, and that was that in the last 80 years, the population on planet Earth has tripled. I thought, that can't be right. And sure enough, that's accurate, that if you know somebody who's 80 years old, they were born into a world with one-third the current population. And I'm of the belief, as are many people, that all of these sort of environmental issues that we see right now, lack of fresh water, you know, possibly global warming, too much pollution, plagues, these are the sorts of things that are not actually problems. They're symptoms of an underlying disease, which, in my opinion, is overpopulation.
We did a show not too long ago about a recent book. It was called The Bet. Paul Ehrlich, Julian Simon, and our gamble over Earth's future. At the time, we talked a bit about Paul Ehrlich, who became famous in the 1970s with his book, The Population Bomb. It outlined a doomsday scenario in which the world's supply of food and resources just couldn't keep up with overpopulation. We have a little clip here of Paul Ehrlich talking on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
We're a small group animal trying to live in gigantic groups, wrecking our life support systems, and we have not come to grips with how to do something about it.
Ehrlich is a very controversial figure. Is he someone who you read closely as you were looking into this overpopulation issue?
Certainly. And I mean, and that, of course, may upset people who are not fans of Paul Ehrlich, but I happen to believe in the power of mathematics. And it's funny, I've had people write, and certainly a lot of people have written and said they're very concerned about overpopulation, but some have written and said, hey, you know what, the birth rate is actually slowing, which is true. I equate that to, you know, all of us in a car driving at 100 miles an hour toward a cliff, and 6 inches from the edge, we start to brake. I don't think it's going to help.
You know, I think one of the things at the heart of that controversy, people who love the work of Paul Ehrlich or at least buy into it, and people who don't like it, is this basic premise that we either need more people in this world in order to grow and innovate, that indeed more people will help us grow our way into a better future, versus the idea that we need fewer people so that we can survive. Some people see Ehrlich's view as a doomsday scenario. Some people take the other view and say, you know, for not just Americans, but the human race to really thrive and survive, we need to have more of us, and we need to explore in a new way. This is a very powerful idea about where we're going as a species. I'm wondering how deeply you've thought about some of these issues as you wrote your book, and potentially stir up some controversy of your own around this.
Well, you know, I thought about them long and hard. One thing I try to do in all of these books is to argue both sides of the equation. I mean, if I've done my job well, when you close the book, you're not quite sure if the villain's a hero or a villain, which you noted earlier. You know, it's one of these topics, as, you know, similar to religion or Vatican politics or any of these things that I write about, where you really can argue. There are great arguments on both sides, and I feel like my job is to get readers interested in the topic. Whether or not they agree with whatever they take away from the book is really irrelevant. What they need to do is just be interested in the fact that our population has grown dramatically, that there are quite possibly technologies that will come along that will enable us to live in the future with an overpopulated planet, but, you know, maybe not.
We're talking with Dan Brown, whose books Inferno and The Da Vinci Code are not just bestsellers, but huge global sensations. He's going to be talking with me at Hartford's Mark Twain House and Museum, actually for the Twain House, at the Bushnell in Hartford on Saturday, June 7th. If you want to find out more information about that, it's marktwainhouse.org. We're previewing this conversation, giving you a chance to ask some questions of Dan Brown. If you've read his books and you have some thoughts about some of the things we're talking about today, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Have you gotten a chance to read this most recent National Climate Assessment that paints a very bleak picture of what we're doing to the planet and how quickly temperatures are rising, ice sheets are melting, etc.?
I've certainly read the highlights, and it's incredibly alarming. And, you know, the funny thing about that is whether or not you believe this is man-made, you know, the man is causing this change or not, it's happening. And why it's happening is really kind of irrelevant. It's happening, and we need to do something about it. You know, and the real concern is that, you know, a lot of these scientists are saying, actually, there's not much we can do. We're going to need to learn to live in a different kind of world.
As we talk about the idea of overpopulation, you know, it makes me think about the Da Vinci Code and how many Catholics were upset because of not just the, you know, alternative portrayal of the life of Jesus Christ, but also some of the ideas around the Vatican. Now a book about overpopulation has faced some of the same criticism from religious groups. How have you addressed that criticism coming from very religious people who feel that the themes that you're talking about are in many ways offensive to their belief systems?
You know, I actually haven't had that much pushback from the Catholic Church or Christianity as a whole on Inferno. I think I mentioned the Vatican only once to say that they had gone into Africa behind the World Health Organization, who had spent years and millions of dollars there distributing condoms and teaching people about sexually transmitted diseases, only to have a bunch of missionaries go in behind them and tell everybody they'll be damned if they use them, which, you know, which was pretty upsetting to a whole lot of people who felt that some of these diseases could be prevented. You know, as far as how I deal with the criticism, I essentially try to write books that let people think about topics that I find interesting. It doesn't matter to me whether somebody agrees or disagrees with whatever the premise of the novel may be. The idea is really just to spark a debate. So on some level, I have to welcome any sort of criticism because it is debate. And that's really, you know, how I fall on that.
What's your religious background?
Well, I was raised Episcopalian. My mom was was the choir director and the church organist at an Episcopal church in New Hampshire. I was in the choir. I was confirmed. I went to Bible school. My dad is a mathematician and a textbook author, and he teaches math at Phillips Exeter Academy. And I sort of grew up in these conflicting worlds of science and religion, and everything was fine for quite a while until I learned about the Big Bang at about the same time I learned about Adam and Eve. And I got a little confused and asked a priest which of the stories was true. You know, did God create Adam and Eve, or did we evolve? Or, you know, did the Big Bang happen, or did God just sort of make the heavens? And this priest responded, nice boys don't ask that question. And that was really the moment that I started studying science. I started moving away from religion. And I should just add, it's as a caveat, that I studied a lot of science, a lot of physics. And the further you progress into physics in particular, the mushier the ground starts to get. And physics, advanced physics, starts looking a lot like religion, and you really just come full circle and realize that science and religion are really just essentially two different languages. They're trying to tell the same story, trying to give us some answers.
I love that idea. The whole concept of theoretical physics really, at the end of the day, is quite a bit like religion, isn't it? It's fascinating and hard to pin down.
It is absolutely hilarious to talk to some of these people who have been hardcore physicists their whole lives, and suddenly they're having religious experiences. You know, they're over at CERN and they see some results and they sort of scratch their head and say, "Well, that means there must be a God." So it's kind of amusing.
This idea of science and religion needing to be in conflict seems to be something that we hear about a lot in American society, certainly. And I don't know if there really needs to be the type of split there is. It's clearly something you've grappled with. Can you talk a bit more about that? Because it seems as though we almost have divided into two camps, either those who believe in religion or those who believe in science. But I've interviewed many people who are scientists who clearly believe in some sort of higher power, but they don't believe in the way the church may teach it. I think that this is something that more of us would like to see, people who are grappling with both ideas as opposed to rejecting one or the other.
Sure, I agree wholeheartedly. You know, a lot of the problem, I think, is just nomenclature, that, you know, we need words to define what it is we're talking about. And, I mean, even among religions, you know, somebody says God and somebody has a different word for God, and they argue. They're actually arguing the same thing. They're just arguing over vocabulary on some level. As far as the battles between science and religion, I think those battles occur with people who are at the beginning of their religious evolution and at the beginning of their scientific evolution. I think that deeply spiritual people who have progressed long down that progress line of understanding spirituality, understanding their thoughts about God and the soul and the heavens and all of that, are much closer in ideology to those scientists who have simultaneously progressed a long way down their progress line and started to understand that, wow, you know, the deeper we go into science, physics becomes metaphysics and numbers become imaginary numbers, and we now know that matter itself, we're not even sure it exists. It's just really matter is now considered to be nothing but trapped energy. And, you know, hey, the Bible says that God is nothing but energy, and God is all around us. So maybe we're saying the same thing. And I think it's those people who are a long way down that line and understand at a very high level will look at each other across the aisle or the altar and say, I guess we're saying the same thing. We just say it in slightly different ways.
A term that comes to me, I think you may have even mentioned, that is a theme whenever anybody talks about overpopulation, is the idea of playing God. And you mentioned the World Health Organization, for instance. One of the things that's always fascinated me from a policy standpoint is that here in America, we will spend hundreds of thousands or maybe even millions of dollars to keep one individual alive through terrible, terrible disease. But those same millions of dollars may be used overseas to save millions of people from some disease that wouldn't kill us here in America. This idea of massive world organizations, global organizations working in Africa of the type that you mentioned, trying to solve these intractable problems, it seems, we never seem to really get anywhere, Dan Brown, right? There's always going to be people starving and dying, and there's going to be too many babies born into terrible, terrible circumstances. Meanwhile, here in the Western world, we're spending the same money just to stay alive for a few years. It's a real paradox right now of living in 2014, I think.
I agree, and it is actually, I believe, a spiritual question. You, it's a question of what is the value of a soul. If you really boil it down, we, on some level, by our policies, are making the argument that one soul that lives well, that is not in poverty, is not in a terrible situation, is, you know, according to our argument, worth the same amount as hundreds of souls that are struggling. And this gets back to overpopulation, where we say, well, if we had 4 billion people on the earth, half as many as we have now, and we could all live well and not struggle because we had enough natural resources, does God prefer 4 billion happy souls, or does he prefer 9 billion souls in varied states of happiness? It's a tough question.
Dan Brown is our guest, and he's going to be joining me on stage at the Bushnell in Hartford. It's a fundraiser for Hartford's Mark Twain House and Museum. It's happening on Saturday, June 7th. If you want more information, go to marktwainhouse.org. This is where we live. You know, another thing that you get into, the way that the hero villain of Inferno is addressing this overpopulation problem, involves genetic engineering. What did you have to learn to write about it in the way that you did in this book?
You know, I had to learn a lot, and I, you know, there's so much I still don't know. I had fascinating conversations with some genetic engineers, you know, of course, they've signed non-disclosures, and I'm asking them all these questions about this this book that I want to write. I said, look, I want a villain who is going to do the following. Is that physically possible with the genetic toolbox you have? They said, yes. Okay. So I'd ask all these questions. Is this possible? And the answer was invariably yes. And finally, they just stopped me and said, no, Mr. Brown, you don't understand. Our genetic toolbox now, with how we can manipulate the human genome and DNA and all of this, is so powerful that there is really nothing we can't do. If you can think of it, we can do it. The only thing that stops us is money and ethics. And that was sort of a chilling thing to realize, that the only thing that's really standing between us and the island of Dr. Morrow is money, and there's plenty of that floating around, and ethics, and there's, you know, seems to be a lot less of that floating around.
That has to be a little bit of a scary thing to hear as you go down this rabbit hole and you talk with these folks, and you're trying to create a villain, which I suppose in every suspense novel is going to be a certain amount of plausible and a certain amount of, you know, a James Bond character. You're actually talking with people who could do all the things that you might cook up in your head.
Well, the scariest thing is as I'm pitching this idea, saying, look, this is what I want the villain to do. Is it possible? And these guys are saying, actually, yeah, and it's a pretty good idea.
And it's a little
alarming.
that's actually very, very alarming. So when you put a book like this out and you have some of this scientific stuff in it, you have people theoretically telling you these things can happen. Have you had some pushback there? People saying, look, this is incredibly far-fetched, or maybe we shouldn't even be considering ideas like this in popular culture?
Well, actually, the pushback has been has been small, but it's been from the standpoint of, well, this is obviously science fiction. To which my response is, well, you know, go read the following, you know, few books, or talk to the following few people, and you'll see it's not actually science fiction. And even if you believe it is, you know, our scientific progress is exponential. So if this can't happen today, you know, give it 3 years and then come back.
Let's go to Mike, who's calling from Griswold. Hi there, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi. You guys may have progressed a little bit beyond this point, but I'd like to take some issue with the idea that the more mature your position in either religion or science, the closer you get to agreement. Science is fundamentally based on observation. Religion is fundamentally based on revelation. They are completely different, and one leads to a lot of problems, religion, and science leads to, well, technology, which can go either good or bad, but are fundamentally different, and they are not, in people in one group and the other that are have mature opinions are not talking about the same thing.
Well, one thing I'll just ask you, though, Mike, and I think you raise a really good point, is that I think on both ends of the spectrum, there is good and bad. There is a lot of beauty that comes to people from religion, as well as a lot of bad. And there's a lot of danger that comes from science, as well as a lot of progress. I don't think it's on a continuum that says there's one good end and there's one bad end of that spectrum.
Your point is well taken, John, but you know, I do not think that Einstein had the same conception of God that a religious person would. If you substitute the term spiritual for religion, I might be a little more amenable to that comparison.
Mike, I agree with that entirely.
Yeah, yeah,
I mean, what you just said about Einstein is totally accurate, and the way you followed up is exactly how I would follow up, that I would say, by definition, people who move deeply into religion become spiritual and start to shed a lot of the dogma and the doctrine, and think in terms more like Einstein. I think your point's a good one.
Mike, thank you very much for that great phone call. We just have a minute left. I want to ask you one last thing. It also has to do with overpopulation. When you When you write these books about these famous places like Florence, a place where I've been, I feel when we go to these places now, they are being crushed underfoot by the weight of humanity to see these beautiful sights, in part because of Dan Brown books, in part because we've written so much about these places. Do you ever feel responsible for the tourism boom that almost seems to be sinking places like Venice and Florence and Istanbul that you write about?
Well, you know, places like Florence and Venice and Istanbul don't need my help. They're spectacular, world-class cities that people have been visiting for a long, long time. And you know, one of my novels coming out may bump the traffic up for a few years. And that certainly does happen. There are tours. The funny thing is I now get calls and letters from the tourist boards of pretty much every major city saying, hey, you know, wouldn't it be great if you set something in Perth?
All of a sudden, the Tourism Bureau there really wants you. Dan Brown, let's continue this conversation in a couple of weeks. Sound good?
Looking forward to it.
Dan Brown is writer of the Da Vinci Code and Inferno. He'll be speaking with me at the Bushnell in Hartford. Go to marktwainhouse.org for more information. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. After more than 70 years, the Charles W. Morgan has finally left Mystic Seaport. This past weekend, the whaling vessel made an historic journey to New London, where Mystic Seaport staff are in the final stages of a five-year restoration project, getting the Morgan in shipshape before it sets out on its 38th voyage this summer. Jay Holt has been reporting the Morgan's story for WNPR. You can check out more of his reporting, along with great pictures of the ship, at WNPR.org. He joins us now, along with Julia Pistel, who will soon board the vessel as one of its 38th voyagers. Welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you very much.
So, Jay, we're going to start with you. You've been following the story of the restoration of the Charles W. Morgan for a while now. So why don't you bring us up to speed? Tell us about this boat.
Sure. First off, the Morgan is a wooden whaling ship built in New Bedford in 1841. Over the next 80 years, she sailed 37 voyages, many lasting up to 3 to 5 years, and she came into Mystic in 1941. Right now, Mystic Seaport is in the very final stages of a massive five-year restoration, and just this past weekend, she left Mystic for the first time in more than 70 years.
Wow, more than 70 years. So that seems like a pretty big deal. I know down in that part of the world, everyone's very excited. Why is it so exciting for everyone?
Well, for some people, it's a big deal on a personal level. Folks like Roger Hambidge, he worked on the Morgan as a shipwright for over 3 decades and then came back to the seaport to help with this current restoration. For his whole career up until now, the Morgan has existed only as a static museum ship.
Now here we are. As I'm speaking, we're heading downriver, and we could probably hear the cheers of the crowd. It's really something to see. It's really cool. That's probably one of the highlights of my life here.
In the bigger picture, after final commissioning in New London, which is what she's there for now, she's going to set off on a voyage to a number of whaling ports in New England. And while there are a lot of tall ships active today, the vast majority of them are replicas, ships that have been built in recent decades, but in the style of vessels from particular eras. But the Morgan is the real deal. When she arrived in Mystic at 100 years old, she was already the last wooden whaling ship remaining of more than 2,700 originally built for the American whaling fleet. And she's currently the oldest commercial vessel afloat in the U.S. So the crew that takes her out is going to be sailing an artifact.
Wow. So let's listen to a little bit from the Morgan's new captain. This is Captain Kip Files talking about the ship's upcoming voyage.
I mean, she's built with things that were alive. You know, she's a wooden vessel. And the feel of a wooden vessel and an iron or steel or fiberglass vessels, they're different in the seaway. They talk to you differently. And so the opportunity to take her and actually move her around and sail her and hear those commands again and the creaking of the decks when she's going through a seaway and stuff, that brings her back to life. And this particular voyage is very, very special, and it's all part of her unbelievable life.
It is an unbelievable life, but what do the folks at Mystic Seaport think about all this? It's been there for such a long time.
It has. My sense is that at the beginning of the process of this refit, the idea of taking this last vessel of her kind to sea was hard for some to accept, be it people that were working at the shipyard or had known about the ship for a long time. But now they're feeling a lot of emotions for a lot of folks who have worked around the boat. She's going through a bit of a transition right now. Like Hambidge, all of their experience so far has related to it being static. And now the reality that it is going to sail again is starting to take hold. What Sarah Spencer told me touches on a lot of what I heard from others I talked to there.
It's a mingling. It's a little nerve-wracking. I mean, she's the last of her kind in the world, so you just hope everything goes just as it should. But it's wildly exciting. I mean, she's coming alive again. I've climbed on the ship. I've felt the rig in my hands and under my feet and hung out on the yards. But to actually do it while she's underway, this ship is at the heart of probably most people who work at the seaport. And to be part of that is mind-boggling.
So Sarah Spencer is an employee of Mystic Seaport, right? She's been selected to sail on the vessel for its 38th voyage. In a moment, Julia Postel will talk with us. She'll be aboard for a part of the ship's journey, documenting her experience. But this idea of a boat coming back to life that Spencer talks about, this is pretty strong. I mean, it's made of wood. This wood was cut a long, long time ago. So this is a pretty powerful idea.
Yeah, and it's a reaction that just about everyone I spoke with has had to some degree about the ship. They find it in different moments, and for some it's a different time that they find it coming to life. But it's not uncommon to envision boats coming to life as they start doing what they were built to do. It's just really interesting that this one has taken so many years to get to this point for these people.
So let me bring in Julia Postel, Director of Writing Programs at the Mark Twain House and Museum in Hartford. So tell us what exactly you're going to be doing on the Charles W. Morgan.
Sure. Well, the Mystic Seaport is doing something that's just absolutely genius from my point of view, and also just a great opportunity for them. What they've done is they're inviting artists and intellectuals of all kinds to get on and off the ship every time they're in port. So every time they stop, a new group of people will go on the ship, and then they will sail the next leg collecting information or experience however they see fit. And then those people will produce a product. And those will go into the museum's archives as part of the living, breathing history of the Morgan. So it's not so much that we are just taking in the Morgan passively. It's that we're contributing to its story. So that group of people is called the 38th Voyagers, and I'm one of them. And I'll be writing about trying to experience passages of Moby Dick as we sail along. So that's my personal point of view, because, you know, if you think about it, you know, you can go and you can walk the same trails that Thoreau hiked, or you can do anything like that with so many writers, but you cannot recreate the experience of going on a whale ship. So this is a once in a lifetime opportunity for me to experience the novel in that new way. So that's the perspective I'm taking, but there's so many different amazing people going on it, experts in wood, obviously tons of sailors, lots of visual artists, teachers who are creating curriculum out of the experience. So it should be really cool, and I'm looking forward to it.
So how did you get accepted to do this? How did you get aboard?
Well, actually, that's a funny story because, as you mentioned, I work at the Mark Twain House, and I love Moby Dick so much that I bring it up more often than Huckleberry Finn at our at our workplace. So when the opportunity came up, my coworkers all sent it to me saying, you know, you should do this. This is very exciting, because I think many other museums in Connecticut and beyond recognize that this is just such a unique opportunity. I mean, they're really taking a museum piece and they're putting it where it was meant to be. It's so unusual that we get to do that.
You know, we used to do this back in the day when we would take great voyages. An artist would always come along. I mean, we hear tales on even some of the great Antarctic expeditions of people bringing painters. There were photographers. There was always someone there to capture something. And I remember hearing stories about the Apollo missions and how those men always struggled with the words to describe this thing that they were seeing. Because they were engineers and pilots and astronauts. They weren't poets and writers and artists. And it seems like a really great idea to recapture that much older concept of bringing along an artist to document what's happening.
Absolutely. And they're also, two of the other voyagers are Charles W. Morgan's great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson and Herman Melville's great-great-great-great-great-grandson.
Oh, wow.
So there's such a sense of history, and everyone that I met during the training was so excited about the project, and I can't wait to, you know, get the perspectives of the other voyagers as well as the sailors, as you mentioned.
Are you a seafaring person yourself?
I'm not really. I love the ocean. I love whales, and I'm very excited about that aspect. And really my entry into this world was when I was a kid. I read a book that a lot of listeners are going to know and love called The True Confessions of Charlotte Doyle. It's a children's book. And it just brought me to seafaring literature in a way that was just so powerful and strong for me that I've always loved to read about the ocean. So for me, this is a a translation from from books to reality, which I'm extremely excited about.
Jay, you are a sailor. What can you tell Julia to get her ready for this voyage on this ancient wooden whaling ship?
Oh, man. Just be ready for what you find. I don't know.
Maybe take along some Dramamine. I don't know.
If you need it. I would steer away from the Dramamine. I think you'll be fine. There are other things that you can do if you need it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been out on the water, but I've never been on a historic whaling vessel. And you know what? Neither has anyone else. So I'm not that worried.
You know, this idea of bringing the ship back to life, I was thinking about the wood that went into this boat. Jay, how much do we know about how much of it has been restored over the years? I mean, there's the old story about George Washington's axe, right? You know, the handle's been replaced 5 times and the Ted's been replaced 10.
But it's still the same axe.
Yeah, it's still the same axe. I mean, how original is the Morgan from what we know?
It very much the same way. There are a lot of parts that are not original to the vessel. Since Mystic Seaport has owned it, they've gone through a few major restorations, one in the 70s, one in the 80s, and now this one here. Roger Hambidge, who we heard from earlier, is actually participating in this restoration kind of as a documentarian of sorts and has been creating a CAD file that locates all of the different pieces from different ages of the boat. So he could bring up one screen and show you, like, in a 3D illustration, these are all the pieces that are original to 1841. These are the ones from the restoration in the 70s, these in the 80s, and now these are the parts that are new in this particular rebuild. I'm not sure what the percentages are, but there are still substantial portions of it from 1841. The keel, for instance, the main structure at the base of the boat is still the same one that was put in there, you know, 170-some-odd years ago, and it'll be bringing it right back into New Bedford.
My goodness, and it should be an amazing voyage for you, Julie. You were talking about bringing this full circle from a children's book, but also as a great lover of Melville and Moby Dick. This has got to be kind of the ultimate adventure for you.
Oh, my God. My level of excitement is through the roof because when we were doing our training, I got to row a whaleboat and climb the rigging. And these are, for me, these are as fantastical as Alice going down the rabbit hole. That's the same for my imagination and truly the American imagination, almost identical. So few people get to do that. And it just feels magical and so foreign. I'm losing my mind. I'm so excited.
Julia Pistel. She's director of writing programs at the Mark Twain House and Museum in Hartford and a co-founder of CT Improv, the improv troupe that we featured here on WMPR in the past. And that is CT Improv, S-E-A-T-E-A. They're a bit seafaring themselves. Julia, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Jay Holt is a reporter whose work has aired on WNPR and Maine Public Radio. He's also featured at the Maine State Museum and also on Katie Talarski's Radio Adventure Theater. Always good to see you, Jay.
Thank you, John. Good to see you, too.
As Julia Pistel gets ready for her artistic voyage on the Charles W. Morgan, we started thinking about the other artists who gather at Mystic Seaport each year for the Sea Music Festival. This year, the festival takes place June 12th through the 15th and features seafaring music from the Netherlands, Alaska, England, Nova Scotia, and all over the U.S. But since we're talking about a famous whaling ship, let's hear from the Barely Whalers. They're a group of men from the island of St. Vincent in the West Indies. Their town has a long history as a center for whaling and the accompanying musical tradition of shanties in a very specific Caribbean style. Let's listen to them sing Seven Long Years.
7 long years into the ocean. Oh, my holy river. 7 long years, I never touch one.
We are on the way. Misery.
news about our danger.
Oh, my Holy River.
Only the mighty knows about our hardship.
We are bound away from this world. Up misery.
When I hit the before, she rolled and shivered.
That's the Barely Whalers from the island of St. Vincent in the West Indies. They'll be part of the Sea Music Festival at Mystic Seaport, June 12th through the 15th. You can go to mysticseaport.org if you want more information. Coming up, WNPR reporter Patrick Scahill will tell us about his new science blog, The Beaker, and he'll also talk about the history of ham radio and some of its connections to our state. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, we're going to listen back to a conversation we had to launch our Made in Connecticut series. We're going to talk about bringing jobs back to Connecticut. How can we keep the skilled manufacturing jobs we do have in our state? We'll listen to this conversation with a panel featuring Senator Christopher Murphy. I hope you can join us on Monday's Where We Live. Today, we're going to introduce a new segment where we visit with our science reporter, Patrick Scahill, and talk about his new blog, The Beaker, which you can find at thebeaker.org. Welcome back to the show, Patrick.
Hey, John.
So what exactly is The Beaker? What's going to be on the site?
Well, as you said, it's our new science blog. It has everything from long-form explanations of how the universe blew up to histories of FDA drug approval, even stories on glass eels in Connecticut. So science, environment, technology, it's all there.
You may periodically see a funny critter picture as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, and a few GIFs.
And a few GIFs.
Or GIFs.
A few GIFs or GIFs. We'll find out. Well, we wanted to learn more about a bit of history that you've reported on for NPR, and that's the history of ham radio. Now, on May 18th, the American Radio Relay League celebrated its 100th anniversary. They're the largest association of ham radio hobbyists in the U.S., and it's headquartered right here in Newington, Connecticut. You've been covering this anniversary, and I want to talk a bit about Hartford's connection to ham radio history, but first, let's define what ham radio exactly is.
Right. So ham radio, basically, it's one of the first widely used wireless technologies. So, okay, what do we mean by that? Ham radio is basically, they don't use transmission wires. They use nature's built-in phone line, was how it was described to me, and that's the ionosphere, so the atmosphere. And they use it to reflect speed of light signals from the radios they use off the atmosphere, which these days can actually carry those signals thousands of miles and in some cases even off the surface of the moon. So if you're wondering how this is done, there's actually a designated portion of the radio spectrum that's been set aside for ham radio operators. And one person described it to me like this. We set aside land for national parks. We'll set aside a portion of the radio spectrum for ham radio operators.
Hold it. They bounce signals off the moon?
Yeah. So it takes a lot of skill to do that. But certain folks who are very good at targeting these radio waves can actually time it so they can bounce these off the moon and send it back to Earth. It's really cool.
So these folks are not just hobbyists, but they're real technicians. They understand their craft. How exactly did we come up with the name ham to describe these people?
Right. So there's actually a lot of different stories about that. For the answer, I met up with Sean Kutzko. He's a ham radio operator with the American Radio Relay League. Again, that's the largest association of ham radio hobbyists in the USA. They're based right here in Newington, Connecticut. And he told me, as I said, there's a lot of stories about how this name came about. But here's the most widely accepted version.
The folks that participated in amateur radio at that point in time, the experimenters, were kind of looked down upon by the professional operators of the day, the professional telegraphy operators. And they were deemed to have a poor fist, which is, you know, if you have a poor fist, you're not a good sender of telegraphy. So those people became known as hams, and that just seems to have transferred over to the hobby. You know, now amateur does not necessarily imply lack of skill. For example, amateur athletes are everywhere, but the term ham just seems to have stuck.
Wow, so it's sort of a pejorative that just
right.
stuck with them for
yep.
all these years.
And they've appropriated it.
So what's the Hartford connection to all this?
Well, I asked that question of Sean Kutzko as well, and he says it all goes back to this one guy, Hiram Percy Maxim, who ultimately was one of the co-founders of the ARRL, as these folks call it. Maxim, he was an inventor, and he actually came from a family of inventors. His dad invented something called the Maxim machine gun, and his uncle actually developed an explosive called Maximite, so I guess they like putting their name in their products.
And he also founded Maxim magazine, I believe.
That's
Is that right?
maybe.
I may have made that up. Anyway, please continue, Patrick. Yeah.
And Hiram actually came up with a lot of cool ideas himself. According to his obituary in the Hartford Courant, he was kind of obsessed with noise, and in particular, abating noise. So he invented a silencer for guns. That technology then went on to develop silencers for diesel and gasoline engines, air compressors, air conditioners, and a lot of other applications, which are actually still used today.
Wow.
So he had this sort of noise obsession, and running parallel to that was an obsession with radio. So he dabbled a lot in amateur radio. And to understand the Hartford ham radio connection, to answer your question here, we have to go back to a meeting of the Radio Club of Hartford in 1914. Maxim was actually trying to send a message from Hartford to Springfield, and Kutzko picks up the story from here.
He was having difficulty doing so, but he knew an amateur operator about midway between Hartford and Springfield, Massachusetts, which is only about 60 miles or so. But in 1914, that was a difficult distance to try to communicate directly. So he gave his message to the station midway, and that was what sparked the notion of having relay stations set up around the country, and that was how the American Radio Relay League was born.
So you'll notice one of the phrases Sean used there sparked the notion, and this actually gives me a nice segue to talk about early radio technology. So today we tend to think of ham radios as kind of these elaborate setups, you know, big microphones, lots of radio dials, headphones, that sort of stuff. But in the earlier days, back in the early 20th century, there were simpler machines that were used, and Hiram Percy Maxim actually used a machine called a spark gap transmitter. You can see a picture of it on our blog at thebeaker.org. And he called it Old Betsy. It's still housed at the ARRL in Newington. And I actually brought along some sound of an old spark gap transmitter. I should say it's not Old Betsy, but we can hear the sound right now.
Okay, so what's it doing? How do these spark gap transmitters work?
So they date back to the late 19th century, and basically it works like this. Picture two conducting electrodes placed very close together, separated by air. When you send an electrical current through one of them, the current will eventually jump the gap and sort of zap the other side, which is what we're hearing there. When it does that, electromagnetic waves are released into the radio spectrum, and some energy also gets released as light and sound, which again gives us that sort of zap spark sound that we're hearing. So if that's confusing, I called up an expert. His name is Bob Allison. He's a senior test engineer at the ARRL, and he'd actually just gotten back from something called Hamvention 2014
nice.
In Dayton, Ohio. It's a ham radio convention. He explained spark gap transmitters to me using an everyday example.
Yeah, well, if you ever listen to AM radio and you turn a light switch on and off in your house, you'll hear a little buzzing sound because the switch momentarily has a little arc across the contact, a little spark, and then you'll hear that buzzing little popping noise in your AM radio.
So, and as we heard in the spark gap cut there, early spark gap transmissions were basically just a lot of transmit pops. So now how well that was done took a long time to develop, and it involved a lot of smart folks like Nikola Tesla and Marconi. Marconi, of course, the father of radio, was the first person to send a radio signal across the Atlantic Ocean in 1901. It was a Morse code signal of the letter S. And he had some financial incentives to do this as well, we should say. He was actually looking to kind of bypass landline telegraph systems that were out there in order to come up with a system that was wireless, so he could charge money to send signals that way.
Smart guy.
Yeah, exactly. So he developed a lot of ways to do this, bigger sparking apparatuses, better antennas, and ways to detect those electromagnetic waves as well. Bob Allison told me about one of those ways. It's a device called a Cohair. Marconi used it, and it was actually developed by an Italian physicist in the late 19th century. When a signal comes in, it would sort of decode it. So here's Bob explaining how it works.
And what it is, it's... It's metal filings, nickel, sometimes iron. They use nickel. And what happens is when a radio wave is detected, the metal filings will kind of stand up and align themselves in a direction which allows the filings to conduct electricity momentarily. And you'll hear a click in an earphone because of that. Now, to shake the filings back up again, every time the headphone clicked, a bell tapper tapped the side of the glass file and loosened up the filings. So the operator would then wait for the next impulse to come in. So it was a series of click, 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 click.
My goodness, this is amazing. Yeah. This is the way they were able to make transmissions.
It's really ingenious when you think about it. I mean, these are very, very smart people, as Bob told me.
We were talking with our smart person, Patrick Scahill. He is our science reporter, and he's got a new blog called thebeaker.org, which you can check out more on ham radio, which is what we're talking about here. So where exactly were these spark gap transmitters used?
Well, they were used all over. In the early days, Bob Allison actually said they were used on a lot of ships.
It would only go maybe 10 miles, 20 miles or so. It wouldn't go that far. But if you're a lighthouse tender or you're on a lightship, you could radio back to shore, for instance, or radio to another ship. And that was convenient at the time.
And as the tech got better, it went on bigger and bigger ships. The Titanic actually had an advanced spark gap transmitter, Bob told me, called the rotary gap. And the technology was used throughout World War I. So here's the one thing we should say. The efficiency of these devices, it's not that great. Basically, you're sending a lot of energy into it, and it's sort of just broadbanding out a radio signal. And that's basically an inefficient use of the radio spectrum. So technology got better. New things came about, vacuum tubes, something called continuous wave transmission, and spark gaps basically began to fall out of use. Bob Allison told me ham radio operators stopped using them around the 1920s. And here's something else that's sort of interesting. Eventually, these things actually get outlawed by the government. Because, again, remember, these devices send out a really broad wave signal, signals that today basically would kind of wipe out your radio reception. So if you think of when you're listening to AM radio during a storm and lightning hits and you hear this sort of crackle on the radio, that's essentially what this would do. So, you know, if you want to pick up, you know, shows like yours, that's not good.
See, you mentioned, both you and Bob mentioned something that a lot of our listeners won't be familiar with. AM radio?
Well,
maybe,
that's right.
Maybe that's an entirely different story. Well, look, before I let you go here, there's a lot that we can learn about ham radios, and there's a lot of information on your website, thebeaker.org, if you want to learn more and see some pictures. But one thing you said earlier just fascinates me. You talked about hams able to bounce their transmissions off the moon or use the atmosphere to transmit very long distances. In your story, you talk about a ham radio operator just magically picking up someone from Japan. So how does that work? How do they transmit such long, long distances?
Yeah, so again, it's using the ionosphere. So this is about 50 to 60 miles off, and basically it acts like a mirror, bouncing radio waves back down to Earth. One interesting story that one of the ham radio operators told me was he was sending out something called a CQ, which is the signal they send out saying basically like, hey, I'm here, talk back to me. So he said his name, his call sign, and then CQ, and then instantaneously he hears himself in his headphones again. And I'm like, well, why did that happen? And he's like, oh, it traveled all the way around the globe. So in certain conditions, this signal can actually just continuously bounce atmosphere, atmosphere, atmosphere all around the Earth and then come back to someone.
But on there are certain days, I would assume, that the ionosphere is better for this than other days.
Yep. So one of the things that we deal with here at our radio station is solar flares. And sometimes those can interrupt radio signals. Same thing with ham radio. If there's a lot of solar energy out there, it can basically disrupt the ionosphere, cause some ripples in that mirror, which can make the signals hard, you know, hard to pick up and send.
It's a fascinating world, and ham radio operators know more about radio certainly than I do, and I've been doing radio for a very long time. I just talk into a microphone every day. What do I know? Patrick Scahill, he is our science reporter at WNPR, and he's got a brand new blog called The Beaker, and you can find it at thebeaker.org. You can learn all about science and also see some funny pictures of critters
and
that sort of thing. Patrick, thanks so much for stopping by. Our program is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. Katie Tolarski is the executive producer of Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Have a great weekend.